Good morning, Ithaca, Watkins Glen. This is WRFI 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and my name is Eric Clay, and our guest on this hour is Diane Carruthers. Am I pronouncing that? To ask you that beforehand. So, Diane, just help us start by giving us a brief description of who you are. Maybe some stories or labels or qualities that will help us to get this conversation going.
That's always a hard question for everybody to answer, I'm sure. And I wonder why that's true. I think our identities are so complex. So it's hard to figure out where to start. But I think the first thing I'd have to say is I'm a mother of three grown young men. And who are just beautiful people. It's probably that's the thing I'm most proud of in my life. Uh-huh. I'm a partner. I have a life partner who we've been together for about 23 years, and that's very important to me. There are a lot of words I would use to describe myself. I'm pretty quiet, introvert.
And this is a big stretch.
This is a big stretch for me. Kindness and compassion are important to me, things I try to practice and don't always hit the mark, but work at that. But probably the thing in my life that gives me the most passion, I think, is my work. I have been lucky to be an educator at the Alternative Community School, now the Layman Alternative Community School, for about 25 years. And that brings a lot of joy to my life and a lot of, it's a place where I have found myself and have grown a lot, and it's a place where hundreds of kids have found their place in the world, too. I would say that that's my driving passion in my life.
I mean, the image of kindness, compassion, and finding one's place. And joy, those are the major words you just used, and that's very, very powerful for your life, your partner's life, your son's life, and the youth that you work with. You in that similar vein, you brought a song for us to start the show with.
And, I did,
and it's a song that is kind of a melancholy song.
It is,
but it asks those same sorts of questions as we witnessed opportunities lost. And Abraham, Martin, and John, and this is Dion's song from the late 60s?
It was 1968.
Right
and
after.
I graduated from high school in 1969. It was the era of political music and protest music, and this isn't a hard protest, but it does speak a powerful message, I think, that probably resonates with people of my generation even today. And I look back on that song, and it sounds a bit naive to me now, maybe we can talk about that more later, but it is a beautiful song.
Right. Yes, let's talk about that later, because it also played where I grew up, which was in rural northwest Missouri, in a community that had been progressive, had a woman mayor in the 1920s, but was becoming redneck and conservative in those years. But this was a song that still was able to span those divisions as they were happening. Here we go.
Anybody here see my old friend Abraham? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. You know, I just looked around and he's gone. Anybody here seen my old friend John? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed the good they die young. I just looked around and he's gone. about a year. See my old friend Martin. Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. I just looked around and he's gone. Didn't you love the things that they stood for? Didn't they try to find some good for you and me? Then we'll be free someday. He's gonna be one day anybody here. See my old friend Bobby. Can you tell me where he's gone? I thought I saw him walking up over the hill. Abraham and Martin.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Diane Carruthers, and that was Abraham, Martin, and John from Dion in the late 60s. Now, Diane, you had said that song now was important to you, and mm-hmm. you can tell us about why it was important, but why also does it seem naive now?
Well, I chose that song really as a stand-in for a lot of the music of the era, and even though the song is very sort of melancholy. Mm-hmm. I think that the deaths of John Kennedy and Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy catapulted my generation mm-hmm. into an era of protest and rebellion and revolution mm-hmm. and a belief that we could change the world. Mm-hmm. So that song I chose is kind of a stand-in for that era. And
you graduated from high school in 69
yeah.
and you were part of the, you know, the protest movement that went on to campus in a much more aggressive way than it had the prior
right
years.
Yeah. Now I didn't go to college at that point oh. but was still sort of wrapped up in the politics of the moment for the next decade through the 70s. And I think we really did believe we could change the world, and in some ways we did, but in some ways things have gotten worse, I think. And so the song represents like a strong feeling of hope, I think, mm-hmm. even in its melancholy. And I think about hope very differently today, and speak to my students about it a little bit differently. 'Cause,
what changed? How
yeah.
did you think about hope?
And well, I, you know, back then we showed up at rallies and demonstrations and so on because we hoped we could change the world and we thought we could. And I think now we show up because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. There are some things that maybe we can't change, like climate change, for example, is probably beyond the point where we can have a huge impact, but we do what we can anyway. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of, I think that's the message I want young people to know today, is that whether things change or not, it's our obligation to step forward when we can.
And how does that attitude foster hope? What is hope in
Well, I don't
sense.
Mean it to be a sort of yeah. nihilistic
right. no,
message.
But, no,
yeah.
No.
I think it's just in empowerment that we mm-hmm. we are empowered. We can it's not that we won't make a difference. We will make a difference in stepping forward. But
right.
but we do it because it's the right thing to do, more so than, because if we know that Some of the problems today are so large that it's hard to imagine that we can really have an impact, and that can make us feel hopeless.
That, right. And also, I think that from my vantage point, loving a brother who went to Harvard in 1969, was kind of on a full scholarship, and he had also an appointment to the Air Force Academy. We grew up in rural poverty, so he made it, but he came back a long-haired Marxist, and people, he just couldn't, in the town couldn't deal with him, and yet I could love both him and the people, many of the people in the town. And what I saw in the 60s and in this music was, this was a tempered form of self-righteousness. And so much of the 60s on all sides was about self-righteousness. And we haven't come to terms with how you just show up and not and don't expect to win on your terms. The whole thing can move forward. With a wicked problem, you're going to do one thing one time, opposite thing the next time, and somebody over there is going to need something different than you ever thought of. So none of us are going to be the judge. And we're going to tie ourselves up in knots if we try to get that kind of coherence out of it. But I think that's what you're saying about hope. You can be in the middle of the fray, engaged, and it matters that you show up fully present and accounted for.
And all the men mentioned in that song are flawed. You know, they all, and that's all been uncovered and gone over and over again. And that, I think, led to a, you know, times of feeling like our leaders are not really leaders, whatever. So I think we've had
all sorts of backlash. And they go left to right, but they also go on individual human nature issues. So what I hear is that you want students to grasp some of the complexity without shutting down. How do you do that?
Well, maybe I can speak a little bit about my school,
We've jumped into a specific topic really quickly, so we may back up a little bit here.
The Layman Alternative Community School, where I'm currently the principal, is a school that our mission is really to motivate kids to have kids find their own motivation, I guess, and not to motivate them, to find ways to connect to each individual student so that they can find what gives them passion and what motivates them. You know, we do that through a lot of different ways, but I think democracy is a big piece of that. So student voice and democracy and having kids engage in their own learning in that way to be a major part of how we make decisions and to learn through daily practice what it means to be an active citizen in your community or an active participant in your community. So in those ways, and understanding that problem solving is, you already said, complex. It's very complex. It's not so simple. We had a simplistic notion in the 60s and 70s of what change might look like. And now I think it's much more, we see it as the complexities and the nuances and the need for compromise and the need to meet somebody halfway or the need to really deeply listen to somebody who across, you know, to listen deeply across those differences and to find common ground where you can and to find respect where you can. So those are, you know, those are some of the big values I think we really try to work with at the school.
That's neat. And we're going to come back at some of these issues in a slightly different way now. So what have been the major experiences or some of the experiences that have really defined or focused your life?
Well, I think growing up in a big family, in a blended family, I was one of seven children, stepchildren, and my stepfather and mother came together each with, my mother had two children, my father had four, and then they had a child together. So I was the oldest girl in that big family, and this was in the 50s, and it was very gendered family. So as the oldest girl, there were a lot of responsibilities that fell to me. And in some way, I love the values of that I grew up with very and hold them very dearly to me. But in other ways, I felt like sort of like the stork dropped me off at the wrong the wrong doorstep. Because I was all, you know, I always had these passions about, you know, I mean, I this was in the 50s and early 60s. It really resonated with me that I really wanted to change the world. I really wanted to be a part of that change. And, you know, and my family kind of teased me about that and, you know, laughed at me a bit. And, you know, so they didn't share my vision necessarily.
Right. And it sounds like it bordered between fun and humiliating.
Right. And yeah. I had a brother who was drafted in the Vietnam War, and it wasn't anything we could talk about openly in my family about what that meant. I would imagine that was true for many families during that time. It was too scary to think about whether, you know, your sons would come home or not, your brothers would come home. And he did come home, but he came home scarred, you know, by his experience. And that's been a hard thing to talk about, you know, in our family all these years. So that's an early piece of it, is sort of living through that era, having a brother who served in Vietnam. And I married very young and had children very young and put aside my own college aspirations to be with a man who was finishing college and finishing graduate school and so on. So it took me until my 30s before I went to college. So that's another big, I think, influence on my life, that my education came later.
Right.
My formal education, anyway, came later in life.
Right. What possessed you to make such commitments, both to a husband and to children, so young? What about your sense of the importance of relationships made that happen, as opposed to taking care of your own education first?
Well, because of the family I grew up in, family was very important. There was always room for another person at the table, even with seven children. You know, the joke in my family was, throw another potato in the soup and we'll set another place at the table. Yeah. So that was very important to me, and those values today still are very, very important to me. And also, people in my family did not go to college. My parents did not go to college. None of my siblings went to college. And I found myself as a senior in high school wanting to fill out applications and figure out how to go to college, but I didn't have that support at home to do that. Not that it was so terribly, well, actually, when my kids got around to filling out college applications, I realized it was pretty complicated, and I had been through it myself by then, so I could help them. But the message was, no, that's not what we do. So what else is there to do besides get married very young and have a family? So that's what I did. So I carried that value forward and set aside my own. So it was I felt like I, you know, the split thing in me wanting very much to join that hopefulness, the idea that we could change the world, and also, you know, feeling that this was my fate in life, or this was the way things were done in my family that I was following.
This was your path.
This was my path.
You didn't have a lot of choice about it.
That's right. Is to, to get married young and have a family.
So what changed?
Well, we had three children, and he was very career oriented, and we moved to Ithaca. That's how I got to Ithaca, where he took a job here, and then once we were here, he decided to take a different job, which would move him away. And I, at that point, I was, you know, we had been married about 13 years, and I didn't want to move around with him anymore, and just said, no, I'm going to stay here. So he left and went on to his, you know, career, and I decided to stay here and figured out how to return to school, to go to school, and went to Cornell and graduated from Cornell. And
children in tow.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It was quite, I don't know, looking back how I did that, but, but I did it. And it was also, you know, it was the 80s. It was a time, this will kind of lead us into our next song.
That's what I was thinking.
It was a time where, you know, you can imagine I was had this image of myself in my, you know, in my boots and in my, you know, finding my own power and being a powerful woman and raising these three kids on my own and getting my own education. And so the next song we're going to listen to sort of represents that. It also just add, because I think this will carry us through to another theme in my life. This song also speaks to being okay with the mystery in life and being okay with the uncertainties. And that's a big piece of who I am as well.
Wanting to be able to change things in a concrete way, but not having to force that clarity when you don't yet understand it or can't really.
Yeah, or that the process is what's important.
Yeah, well said. Yeah. Very well said.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done for me used to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah. Well, darkness has a hunger that's insatiable. And lightness has a call that's hard to hear. And I wrap my fear around me like a blanket. I sail my ship of safety till I sank it. I'm crawling on your shores. And I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find, yeah. Closer I am to find, yeah. And I went to see the doctor of philosophy with a poster of Rasputin and a beer down to his knee. He never did marry or see a big great movie. He graded my performance. He said he could sit through me. I spent 4 years prostrate to the higher mind. Got my paper and I was free. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find, yeah. Closer I am to find, yeah. I stopped by the bar at 3 a.m. to seek solace in a bottle or possibly a friend. I woke up with a headache like my head against a board, twice as cloudy as I'd been the night before. And I went in seeking clarity. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountain. We go to the doctor. We go to the mountains. We look to the children. Seek my source for some definitive. Closer I am to find. Closer I am to find. Closer I am to find.
The less I seek something definitive, the closer I am to fine. The Indigo Girls, closer to fine. Our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Diane Carruthers. So how did you come to embrace this kind of appreciation of process and respect for not knowing or mystery or however, which is not the same as magic?
No. I mean,
but this, how did you come to accept this?
I have never really thought about how I came to this. And I just now quickly, I'm thinking like growing up in a big family was part of it. You know, you could never count on anything for sure.
Right, right.
Because there were many people vying for my parents' attention and for each other's attention and so on. So I don't know, but I do feel like that's...
Right. You could never count on anything, any external thing for sure. Mm-hmm. So what that has to do, I'm the sixth of seven children.
Yeah.
And in a two-bedroom house, 450 square feet, tiny rural poverty. My older brother slept on the back porch. I slept in the closet. When you can't count on those external things, you have to learn by inches and by miles how to count on yourself.
Right.
And there's a trust, not that you will figure it out, but there is something to be figured out.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something you may have learned younger that didn't come to expression until living the set roles fell apart.
Right. That's true. That's very true. And probably by nature, I'm an introvert.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I remember even as a young child or as a teenager, especially spending a lot of time alone in my room or any place where I could find privacy.
Right. It's with just so tough many to do siblings. With so many siblings. Yeah.
Yeah. But true, when the structures of marriage and family fell apart for me, you know, the things I counted on, I really had to face that. That was a big piece of it too, is that things I counted on or I thought seemed so sure based on the way I grew up were not necessarily for sure, you know. That was a big piece of it. And I think it's just been a journey. And then it led me to the school I'm in now, where I really got to experience deeply how important the process is. Dave Lehman talked to us about that a lot, and it made sense to me. It spoke to me that it's the journey. It's not it's the destination, not it's the journey, not the destination. Is what Dave would always say to us, and that just resonated with me. That it's how we get somewhere that really matters, and whether we get there or not is not always the point.
Right, and there could be many different places.
Right, yeah. And where you end up might not be where you thought you were going at all, and that's okay too.
Or you may get there very quickly and realize that's not where you wanted to be.
Yeah, yeah.
What I'm going to ask is going to sound silly, but when you make the transition from living out a plan or an ideal to living with the people who are around you in whatever way you can, my perception has been that we look at each other and we see each other in different ways and we engage each other in different ways so that we feel like we're different sorts of persons. Was there a time in that process in your 30s where you felt like you were a different sort of person than you had been 10 or 20 years before?
Well, it was certainly a time where where a space was created for me to find out who I was, beyond being there to
the role,
the role of
mom
and wife. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So to be in classes, you know, with students half my age who had concerns very different from mine, you know, and because I was older and was in a department that was mostly populated by graduate students and only a few undergraduates, I was able to...
What was your department?
It was rural sociology.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't even know how I picked that, except I knew... I just knew a couple of the professors who took me under their wings, and sort of I got to be a part of this crowd of graduate students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we had night classes and they would be able to sit and debate and argue late into the night, and I would say, like, argue about whether women's labor is productive or unproductive, and I'd be like, I'm sorry, I have to go home and do the dishes and put my kids to bed.
Right, right.
So that was my reality, and and yet I was enthralled. I was fascinated by theory. You know, mm-hmm. It was sort of my introduction to being able to look at life through a theoretical lens and understand what theory is.
What changed in you? What about theory changed you?
To just understand that there are, that there are larger pieces or mm-hmm. larger things, larger factors than just my own individual choice.
Right.
You know, so I understood my choice to get married and have children as my choice. And
didn't see the context in which it occurred.
Yes, exactly. Right, right. So taking these courses in Marxism and feminism really in a very uncomfortable way, mm-hmm. sort of, I had to face, you know, well, not had to face, but I faced the idea that these were decisions that were sort of made for me before I ever got to that phase in my mm-hmm. life by the larger forces in our society. And so that was very startling to me, to come to that understanding.
Right, right. So theory made you a moral agent in a wider universe, whereas you had been, in a sense, a soldier or a servant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It did help me discover my own agency and my own power, you know, that I could have power and say over my own life and go down a different path than the one that was laid out for me.
Right, right. And I'm gonna make what may seem like a totally wild connection here, but to meditate on theory is historically the same as to meditate on God,
mm-hmm.
because each is that perspective on the whole and a structure for understanding it. And our understanding is often imperfect, whether it's of the theory mm-hmm. or of whatever we claim to be important spiritually or religiously,
mm-hmm.
because as humans, we're limited in that way. But we still want that bigger perspective, and that perspective yeah. helps us to navigate our lives. And what I see, and this gets back to your teaching role, is most kids are longing for understanding the environment in which they're living their lives, this huge, big meta environment in which mm-hmm. their narrative is playing out in a small but meaningful sort mm-hmm. of way. And when you can make those links, things fall into place.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Very true. You know, very true. And I think to make the connection back to my life as an educator, that's very true. I think that's my passion, and that's part of why this school works for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Being a member of this community works for me, because it does. Community is a, you know, that's our middle name, the Alternative Community School.
Yes.
And so we really try to see ourselves all the time as individuals, but also part of a larger community. Mm-hmm. And that tension, there's always tension there between those two things, and it's a very good tension.
Right. Yeah. And I imagine that, and see, one of the things is community is one of those words that's just thrown around in this culture. Whenever you want to put a feel good word on something, you call it community. But you talk about the dynamic between the individual and the larger group. But mm-hmm. within communities, there are like different organs within the body. So they function in slightly different ways.
Yeah.
And they may or may not get along with each other very well. But the body without tension is a corpse after rigor is gone.
Yeah.
But so it seems like you're comfortable with that larger play. And as a principal, what is the attitude that you try to approach the students, the faculty, the parents, the constituencies that all, because I mean there are a lot of people who can kind of bear down on the local schools.
Mm-hmm.
What is the attitude that you try to cultivate in yourself as you're engaging the process?
Well, just my own experience as a new teacher mm-hmm. there 25 years ago, seeing kind of coming into this place where I really wanted to teach two of my kids were already students there and really wanted to be part of this school, but kind of walking in and thinking like, what is, you know, is this really a school? Where are the rules? It's very different from the school that I, you know, the kind of education I got. So it really took me, I always like to say 7 years, because kids are with us for 7 years from sixth grade through 12th grade, to really see the process and to see a sixth grader coming in and kind of floundering around in this place that has few rules and, you know, fewer boundaries for them to bump into, but some boundaries definitely there. And as they figure out like what's okay and what's not okay, we've emphasized rights and responsibilities and have a few rules, but try to engage kids in conversation. Like, yes, you have a right to do that, but what's the responsibility that comes with that?
And how do you honor other people's feelings, which sometimes are like landmines or indicators before a right or responsibility has been engaged.
Exactly. Yeah. And that conversation will look different and sound different with a sixth grader than it might with an 11th grader, who hopefully after several years of being in the school will have a deeper appreciation, you know, and a deeper understanding of what my rights are as an individual and what my responsibilities are to the community. So that's why rules don't work, you know, I think, you know, because a rule for a sixth grader or something you would expect from a sixth grader would look very different from what you might expect from an 11th grader. So we try to work within that. And it's hard for people. It was hard for me. It's hard for many of my, not many, but a few of the teachers who might prefer more rules and more sort of black and white, like if this happens, then this should happen. But to emphasize the process more, that it's that we're here to teach, you know, we're here to teach. This is a school. We're here to learn.
Right. In a certain, when I hear people ask, and when I've asked myself for there to be rules with consequences, it's often for lack of a more open vision to say that the process brings its own consequences if you stay open and honest with each other. So you don't need this black and white rule because results, things people will have to adapt or change or respond to things that they wouldn't have wanted to. I had a guest, a Hall of Fame lacrosse coach, who said, we never had rules on the lacrosse train, but we had policies.
And
policies allow us to frame what it is we're going for, but they do not tie our hands for how we get there. And that's what I kind of hear you saying.
Right. Yeah. Not that there are no bottom lines. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some bottom lines, and that we, you know, there are things that kids cross the line and we have to rein them in, but still it's about restoring relationships. If they've harmed someone,
the
and so
line that's crossed is damage.
Yes,
damage has been done to the environment, to other people.
And imposing a rule and a consequence, you know, more, we use the term consequence when we really mean punishment. So to impose a punishment doesn't necessarily give this person an opportunity to make amends for what they did or to reflect on why it is that they did was harmful to another person or to the community.
Right. And it's like cutting off your nose to spite your face. And when you want to, and you're making me see something. A punishment tends to involve the assumption that somebody was too big. They did something that they shouldn't have done, so they have to be knocked back down to size, the right size, which is all about this role stuff, rather than learning, well, you messed something up, how do you try to make it better?
Yeah.
You know, how do you try to get past it? And that would have been a useful piece of learning for me, young.
Yeah.
I mean, we've kind of ambled into it over life.
Yeah.
You've come with another song, These Days, by Jackson Browne.
Yeah.
You wanted the live version. How do we segue? What's the topic that's coming up through this song?
I think that, this song is also a little bit melancholy.
Yeah.
And I didn't necessarily...
You're an honest, reflective introvert.
Yeah.
And it comes with that a certain kind of melancholy.
Right. And I don't want it to be assumed that it's because of my age that I'm in this reflective place, because I think actually Jackson Browne wrote this when he was in his teens. That's what the story
teens
goes.
Teens or 20s,
Yeah. So he was a very young man when he wrote this song. And I think we all go through phases of reflecting on our lives. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm just at this moment, you know, feeling, and I think the job I have now as principal puts me in a position where I have to constantly step back and think, what's the right thing to do right now, because it's hard to, you know, I'm not necessarily a person who feels like I need to please everybody, but it's hard to make everybody happy. You know, it's hard to figure out the right thing to do.
Right. And there's a difference between making people happy versus making them optimistic that this suffering will pay off.
Yeah, right. That's well said.
We will cause each other to suffer. There's no choice about that.
Yeah.
But how we bear with each other.
Yeah. And so while I don't feel major regrets looking back on my life, I do tend to look back and think, could I have done this differently, or what would have happened? Yeah. Yeah. And which I think is a healthy thing to do, mm-hmm. as long as we don't get stuck there, you know, as long as we can come back to the present. And
Carole King had a song even when she was, you know, young, about wishing that she could have been different so she wouldn't have asked him to give up his youth to her.
Oh, yeah.
And there are those ways in which we can have that. It can't change the past, yeah. but you can wish that it would have been different.
And this live version, I think, is particularly beautiful.
Yeah, here we go.
I don't do that much talking these days. These days. These days I seem to think about the things that I forgot to do. And all the times I had the chance to. Forgotten
then. And that was Jackson Brown, These Days. And you're listening to the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Diane Carruthers. Diane, one of the things that I like to kind of get to in the course of the show as we kind of wind down is to, well, actually, this is different, not the question I told you was coming, so I'm going to change it. How have you changed in ways that you had to just make it happen? Or has there been an instance in your life where you've kind of had to just kind of reverse from what you thought was true or what you thought was. Well, you did it to some extent as you ambled through things, the giving up the roles and assuming agency for your own life. Mm-hmm. But have there been things that you've had to kind of reassess? I mean, or how should I put this? We've already talked about how you reassessed the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. and the efforts to end a war movement to change mm-hmm. the world. Have there been things that you've had to do that haven't been welcome, that you've still had to choose to do?
I don't know if I can.
But that's a tough question. And yeah. I ask it because oftentimes we don't even get to the window that would allow that question to be asked. Uh-huh. But put it in the back of your mind.
Okay.
And we may take it off.
All right. Okay.
So. What do you do, this is the question that I had said was coming, to restore your sense of balance, optimism, or strength? What do you do physically, emotionally, intellectually to renew yourself? And mm-hmm. when do you know you need to do it?
Every day. Every day.
You're a school principal.
I am a school principal. But even as a teacher, I found myself thinking, like, what? Why did I ever think I could do this? You know, having to walk into a classroom every day, as a secondary teacher,
yep.
several different classes every day, and be on, you know,
right.
Was a challenge for me, an exciting one, but a real challenge. And now being the principal in a, you know, for 300 students and 50 members of the staff in a pretty small building, interacting and engaging with people all day long. I love it. I truly do love it. But I do find I need to come home and have some quiet, and Saturday mornings are, you know, quiet time.
Sacred time.
Sacred time. Yeah. Drink my cup of coffee before it gets cold, or maybe let it even get cold, but watch the birds out the window and that kind of thing. I also...
They say that, they say that many professional actors are introverts because they're not extroverts and hams because they are more studied in it. But because they're more studied in it, they need more time to step back and
to
take care of themselves. So I hear a little bit of that in your story.
Right. Yeah. I'm not, I do meditate a little bit. I'm not a regular enough mm-hmm. practitioner of meditation, but I am a student of Buddhism. And so that has been very helpful for me in my life, is to remind myself to be present, because I think we wear ourselves out when we are rushing ahead, worrying, or looking back at the past.
I'd rather be here now.
Right. Be here now is restorative for me, remembering to take a deep breath. I also, in the last several years, have tried to do at least one a year, and it's usually very short, a silent retreat is something that's very restorative to me, to just find some time to get away for 2 or 3 days and sit in silence.
Yeah. How did you discover the value or the need for silence?
I think I did from a very early age in a big family, finding a quiet corner of the room, of the living room. The TV might be on with a football game, and my dad usually would have the radio on to a baseball game at the same time. And, you know, my brothers were wrestling around, and I would be in the corner with a book. It was before the days of even a Walkman, or otherwise I probably would have had that on. But a book was a place where I could find my quietness. But I wasn't aware of it. You know, I just knew that I needed to have that. And as I've grown older, I've just understood that that's my nature, to need to have that time to sort of pull back a little bit and be on my own a little for a little while before I can go back out and step up to the challenge of being in a crowd. And also learning even what an introvert was, you know, even once I understood that introverts, we draw our strength and our power from quiet times rather than being in a crowd.
From when you're on.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I live with somebody who's a little bit the opposite, who draws her energy from being in a group, although she needs time on her own as well, but she can be very, very up and on in a group or at a party or in the classroom in a way that is real work for me to do. So just kind of living with her and understanding, you know, our differences and working hard with each other to try to meet those differences and bridge them in ways that are respectful to both of us, I think has, you know, that has helped me grow in my own self-awareness.
Right. You are several guests have said that they had to learn that they were introverts, and I found that interesting, but I guess we live in a culture where we don't kind of reflect on ourselves, you know, several hundred feet away and see what we look like and what we're doing, and it makes sense. I, in terms of like the Myers-Briggs extrovert, introvert, I sit right on the middle of those two. And when I'm in an extrovert mode, the time alone is really more about healing. Whereas when I'm in introvert mode, the time alone is more about melting into.
Right.
And so they serve very different functions. And when I'm on as an introvert performing, I am very much aware of what everybody around me is reacting. But when I'm on as an extrovert, I'm really on the buzz, and I'm less aware of how other people are reacting.
Right.
So it's a funny sort of world.
To try I know to, what you mean.
Yeah.
Because I can hit those notes too as an extrovert, where I'm, you know, buzzed up is the word used, and you know, I'm having fun or whatever, but not very aware, aware of what's going on. And I think my job requires that or to do the job the way it speaks to me requires, you know, sitting, being with people, truly being with people and really listening, keying in and trying to, you know, and I think I'm sensitive to, you know, a person's body language and everything about them. I'm taking all of that in all the time, or I try to in order to be really present and really with that person.
But it's also really important to simply express joy, to simply express fear or disgust, so that people see and feel the integrity of that emotion. And that's where not being so sensitive can actually open it up. Because I imagine as a principal, you open up behaviors to faculty and to students that they wouldn't otherwise think of doing, because you're kind of the behavior in chief.
I hope that's true.
And so being able to go to that edge of abandon might just increase the tone range and the space of the school.
Yeah. And schools traditionally don't allow for that kind of.
We did it through sports, and we did it through theater. And LACS has a long history of theater.
Yes, we do.
But it also is just done by the way we behold each other.
Right. Yeah.
So what do you do physically? What do you do to kind of take care of your body, and how do you integrate that?
That's a good question, because I'm not an athlete at all. And again, I think I'll go back to growing up in a big family with four brothers who are very raucous and rough, and you know, and also a sports-minded family, but the sports were all about boys' sports, so Little League, Pop Warner football and all of that. And the sisters, the girls, we got to sell the snow cones, you know, in the in the concession stand.
And at best, cheerleaders.
So I didn't grow up thinking of myself as an athlete. The moment that came for me, actually, was at ACS, we do trips in the spring, and I joined bike group about 4 or 5 years into my time there. And finishing that first year on bike group was amazing to me. And I remember thinking, nobody's ever going to be able to say that I'm not an athlete again. You know, I felt really accomplished, like I had done something, and stayed in bike group for 5 or 6 or 7 years. I can't remember now. So I kind of began to think about myself differently then. And these days it's the gym. You know, I work out with a trainer regularly and try to keep my core strength up, do some walking and, gardening and those kinds of activities, which are kind of gentle, but I try to push myself with the weight lifting
and gain strength that way.
And
from what I see, as I watch people age, and one of the dimensions of my life is working with people who are in their late 70s, 80s, and early 90s. Yeah. And as those who insist on walking, mm-hmm. and who insist on just that low level of exercise, maybe a little gardening or mm-hmm. whatever, but not the heavy push,
yeah.
but just that constant half an hour a day or maybe more, where they're just kind of ambling along,
right.
but doing it on a regular basis, they tend to be more resilient mm-hmm. physically. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what research shows.
Yeah.
But I've just watched it. And those who either don't, who despise physical activity mm-hmm. or grew up as women who just, that's only what people who don't know how to do their minds would do.
Right.
Use their minds. And that kind of, they have a hard time.
Yeah.
So.
Have to keep ourselves healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. When do you know you need a timeout?
Oh,
and by that I mean just to kind of reflect, to set back and
take. Yeah,
what happens in your life?
I just had a moment this past week where I was in a meeting and found myself just saying things that just, yeah, I wasn't. I left that meeting feeling like that did not go well. I was not
the person.
I wasn't true to the person I want to be. Yeah. And that was a real signal that I hadn't been getting enough sleep, and I hadn't been, you know, using whatever time I had alone to really restore myself. And
were you also getting this cold at the same
time? Yeah, I was getting this cold.
Yeah.
So those moments, you know, when I feel like I'm not being true to who I, that integrity is really important,
right.
guiding a touchstone in my life to really live the person I see myself as being, or I think that I am.
To live the, and integrity can mean a couple of different things. One can mean unwaveringness from the rule, mm-hmm. which I don't think you mean.
No.
But it can also mean being whole.
Being whole.
And being responsive and being up.
Yes.
To be engaged.
Yeah. That's
all of you, fully right. present and accounted for, which is kind of
yeah.
where you started
right.
in terms of your
yeah,
arriving in life.
That's beautifully said. Yeah.
Diane, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this too.
We're going to play Nina Simone, "I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free."
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about that song before we...
Again, I think it's a beautiful, beautiful song. Nina Simone, powerful woman, powerful African-American woman. When you hear that, I think you hear her speak to, we think of race mm-hmm. in the first and foremost because of who she is. But I think she also speaks to any of us who, we all have places in our lives where we're not, where we don't feel free, where we wish we could break mm-hmm. free of those chains that hold us back. So I think there's something in this song for everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's been great to get to know you.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish.